to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. So we've got a great show for you today, and we are going to start with some music from Brian May. Brian May being the guitar player of Queen, and obviously one of the main songwriters in the band. We are going to feature an interview with Dr. Brian May today. It's an interview that was done in 2017. I interviewed Brian May while he was in Montreal in 2017 about his animal rights and animal welfare activism. So in light of that, we're going to start with a song by Brian May from his Back to the Light album. And this is an instrumental tune called Last Horizon. And that was Last Horizon, an instrumental tune by Brian May from his album Back to the Light, which recently was re-released. And it's an old album from the early 90s, and it was re-released, I guess, partly because it wasn't available on things like Spotify or iTunes. And I think Brian May was sort of having some downtime because of the pandemic, and decided to re-release his old original debut solo album. So yeah, so Brian May has been for some years now a campaigner for animal rights and animal welfare. He's actually a vice president of the Royal Society for the Protection of Animals in the UK, and he also in 2010 founded the anti-cruelty charity Save Me, which campaigns for the protection of all animals against unnecessary, cruel, and degrading treatment. And of course, that has a particular emphasis in the UK on preventing the hunting of foxes and the culling of badgers. Brian May also is an astrophysicist and has a PhD in astrophysics, something that he almost completed before Queen began, but went back to school, I guess also in the 90s, I think, maybe in the late 90s or the early 2000s, and finished his PhD, which was on radial velocities in the zodiacal dust cloud, if I remember right. So I spoke to Brian May in 2017 while he was in Montreal at the Bell Centre before the Adam Lambert and Queen gig that he performed in. But I didn't ask him about music. I asked him instead about all of his animal rights and other kind of environmentally related views on things and his participation in different groups and so on and so forth. So here is that interview now. Dr. Brian May of the rock band Queen is often interviewed about his stellar music career and his PhD in astrophysics, but perhaps less often about his tireless advocacy for animals. So today we are going to entirely focus on that topic. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we're here in Montreal at the Bell Centre with Dr. Brian May. How are you doing today, Brian?
I'm very good, thank you, Ryan. Happy to be with you.
I wanted to know, in your scientific training, concern for animals, was that frowned upon by your peers in the scientific community, or did you weren't really at that stage in your thinking then anyways?
I wasn't quite at the stage I am now, but I certainly did have the discussions. And scientists on the whole can be quite insensitive, and their perspectives can be ruled by the fact that they think knowledge is king, etc., and it justifies anything. Not universally the case. You know, there are some very good conscientious scientists, but yes, I've found myself fighting against my own college at one point about the validity of the reasons for causing animals pain to gain knowledge which probably could be gained in other ways. And I'm very much against the old-fashioned scientific view that you can expend any number of animals to get a little bit of benefit to humanity.
And with the badger cull in the UK, you started an organization called the Save Me Trust. Why did you feel that was important?
Well, Save Me was really designed to fight for the rights of all British wildlife. So it started off with foxes, and quickly followed by badgers, simply because I felt they didn't have a voice and decisions were being made without taking into account all the facts. There are organisations in Britain who I guess battle alongside us, but there was definitely a place for an organisation which actually didn't start off as a charity. I just funded it, you know, and that gives you a bit more freedom. And charities are kind of hidebound by certain restraints, and we're not members of a political party either, which would also bind us. We're completely independent and self-funded, although we now have a charitable branch. So I was able to fight, I was able to say things which other people couldn't dare to say, and I think we have an influence. We have an influence with the public, I think, because the public, of course, don't necessarily see all the facts. They don't get them presented to them because it's in certain people's interests not to present them with these facts. So we try and inform the public, even to elementary things like David Cameron, who's about to run for Prime Minister, is in favour of fox hunting and would like to bring it back. Things like that. That's what sort of started us off. I mean, we have another Prime Minister, Theresa May, who's in favour of fox hunting right now. And it might seem like a small issue, but in a sense, I think fox hunting is a kind of litmus paper. Anyone who is in favour of hunting animals for sport, and there is really no other reason, you know, there are sort of lame excuses offered, like, you know, it's wildlife control and it's necessary, but it's all smokescreen. You know, you're looking at people who want to hunt and kill for pleasure. And to me, if they're in favour of that, then the chances are very high that they will be insensitive to human issues as well as all you know, the whole gamut of animal issues. So in a way, fox hunting, I've discovered, is not such a narrow thing as you might think. It's a good indicator of somebody's mindset. So, you know, you look at someone who's insensitive to animals, he's probably going to be insensitive to children and the poor and the sick as well.
And in the UK, is there a cultural divide or is there a historic divide, a class divide between people who sort of see animals more as vermin versus... Because, you know, the UK has a great history of caring about animals and starting organizations like the RSPCA and so on. And then there's this other side of the culture there.
Well, it's an extensive spectrum, isn't it, I suppose? Yes, England likes, and Britain, I suppose I should say, likes to think it's an animal-caring country, but in fact its record is not very good. And of course, yes, there is a cultural divide, but it's not just the cultural divide which splits up attitudes to animals. You know, the fox hunting community, for instance, has a large number of toffs in it, you know, the ancient landed gentry who still have power, unfairly. You know, there's still an amazing inequality in England, which has been emphasised by the last couple of governments and protected. But that community also includes lots of poor people who also like to get into it because they have their own reasons. You know, they make money out of cruelty to animals. So you have these people who will go ahead of the rich people on the horseback, and they'll be the guys who are digging out the foxes or blocking up their holes and organising the hounds being set on baby foxes that they're trained to be vicious. It's a very nasty scenario once you pull the curtain back and see actually what does go on. And it's not the only thing that goes on. You know, we still have badger baiting in Britain. It's apparently on the rise. You know, it's pure cruelty, pure vicious, sadistic nastiness. And I'm afraid in my lifetime that's not going to be a problem that is solved, because that's something that seems to be innate in certain people's nature.
And you know, as a rock star, I mean, you are different, I think, than many people. You're willing to stick your neck out and face criticism for your outspoken views about animals. Has that been not maybe a learning curve for you, but how has that worked out? And you obviously are not going away from the issue. You stay involved. You get involved in the Common Decency Project, which you started to try and influence British politics as well.
Yeah. I'm smiling because, yes, a lot of people have tried to frighten me off. Yeah, I've made a lot of enemies. I try to keep a kind of sense of humour as well as all this, you know, strangely enough. I mean, some of the people I'm up against, I speak to, and in civil terms, and we have a joke now and again. You know, I think you have to keep that. You have to be a decent human being in order to be an example. You know, you can't go around hitting people over the head in the name of common decency. You have to be a decent person yourself. So I try and keep an open mind and see other people's point of view, but at the same time, I'm not going to give ground on the things that I believe in. And I believe in decency and, you know, to all creatures.
And when it comes to medical testing or those kinds of things, I remember when the Mercury Phoenix Trust was set up, and there was money I think you were giving to AIDS research, mm-hmm. You refused to give money to any research that involved animals as models. Is that right?
Yes, we had a few issues, and we solved them in the end, yes.
I think that's a tremendous thing, to sort of force the scientific community to try and go at it from a different perspective.
Well, we don't force them. It's just that we don't support everybody. You know, it's a difference, I suppose. But I like to think we can exert some kind of influence, yes. I'm very close now to an organisation called the Hadwin Trust, which constantly researches methods to replace animal experiments. And mostly the replacements are much, much better than the experiments on animals that they replace. And this is really a consequence of the way medical research is proceeding now. It's much more tied to a certain genome type. So if you're doing experiments on a human being who has a widely different genome from yourself, it's probably not going to have much relevance to you. Much less relevance if you're doing it on a mouse or a rat or a cat or a dog, you know. So there becomes less and less reason to do experiments on animals. I mean, the classic case is the thalidomide tragedy, where this drug to deal with sickness in pregnant women was tested on animals and cleared and given to women, and it produced deformities in the children, which was a massive tragedy. And it illustrates the point that you cannot prove a human drug on an animal that's not human. So why carry on doing it?
In terms of your interest in astronomy, I mean, you were an astronomer. You had a relationship with Sir Patrick Moore, another astronomer, who also had, I think, an interest in animals and standing up for animals.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that there is a connection between having a wild fascination with the cosmos and the world of nature?
I think there is a connection. I think there's a consciousness, yes. And these days I'm privileged to have lots of friends in the space exploration community in NASA and ESA. And I find most of these people share the same kind of feelings that I have. I think you have a perspective. When you look at the cosmos and you start to understand how small we are and what the various probabilities of life are, etc., you start to have a different view on creation, I think, you know. And, you know, creation is now a sort of political word, isn't it? I'm talking about creation with a small c, I suppose. And, you know, why... Well, again, we've sort of said this, but, you know, you look at every animal and think, well, it seems that every animal ought to be important because it's vastly more complex and significant than any inorganic piece of stuff in this universe. You know, you look at all life as precious, and I think that's a good starting point.
Do you believe that animals are intelligent?
I'm not sure that I believe humans are intelligent. Yes, of course. Yes, I do believe animals are intelligent. They have a different kind of intelligence from us. And sometimes they perceive things in ways which we don't fully understand. Yes, I have a massive respect for animals of all kinds. And it goes a long way down what we would perceive as the sort of consciousness list, I suppose. You know, all these sort of fables about fishes going around fish tanks and forgetting that they were there 3 seconds ago. None of it's true. I mean... My wife has had a fish tank for, I think, probably 30 years, and those fishes, some of whom have been living for at least 25 years, know when it's her and it's not me at the tank. You know, they don't forget. They know what's going on, and they know what it means when she approaches the tank. You know, that's just one example. You know, fishes are generally regarded as sort of featureless, consciousness-less beings, but I think nothing could be further from the case. It bothers me that we regard animals as insignificant. And certainly if you start looking at pigs and cows and horses and sheep, you know, pigs are on the whole, I am told, of higher intelligence than dogs. So it becomes pretty unsupportable to treat pigs the way we do, in my opinion. So it's a whole starting point. There's a great book written on this by a man called Foer, F-O-E-R, and it's called Eating Animals. And his first chapter is entitled, "So Why Don't We Eat Dogs?" You know, that's an interesting starting point. And again, we think that animals are stupid and we're the only ones who understand what's going on, but it's not necessarily the case. You know, just because we've succeeded in what we call civilization, which amounts to covering large percentage of the world in concrete, you know, we have our colour TVs and our internet, but it still doesn't prove the point to me. And to me, I could never abide cruelty. You know, there's enough suffering in the world, and to intentionally cause any being pain or discomfort or indignity is, to me, an inexcusable thing. So I have always felt that these people who advocate causing pain or death to animals in the name of sport, I find just completely inexcusable. So that obviously I find myself fighting against that from day to day in my life.
For you, do you think it's important to live your ethics and be the change you want to see in the world?
Yeah, I do. I think it's important to set an example. I'm not the perfect example. I would never claim to be. I've been struggling to be a vegetarian for two-thirds of my life, or probably all my life, you know, and I still have the occasional crustacean, because it's like a habit that dies hard, I suppose. But on the whole, I prefer to eat vegetarian. I actually prefer to eat vegan if it's convenient, but I'm not the perfect person that I would like to be. Nevertheless, I spend a lot of my time trying to decrease the suffering that we cause to animals. And strangely enough, a lot of the people that I work with are at all different points on the spectrum of carnivorousness. You know, some of the people who are very helpful to us in fighting unnecessary cruelty to badgers and foxes are meat eaters. And that doesn't cause me not to speak to them or to look down on them. I just think they're in a different place in their own personal development.
You've supported the Harper Asprey Wildlife Rescue and with Anne Broomer. And I'm curious how you got involved in that project and why you think that's important.
That was the most wonderful serendipity in my life, really, when Anne Broomer came along and said, can I use some of your land to make runs so that we can soft release rescued animals? I looked at her quite blankly because I didn't understand what soft release was at the time, and went, yes, okay, this sounds like a good idea. What can I do to help? And it completely changed my life. You know, from a person who, I suppose, had a wish list of things that he might like to do for animals, I became a person who actually was able to start doing things for animals. So we do things at a completely grassroots, hands-on level, saving animals. Well, she does, you know, and her staff. I support it. It's now, you know, part of me, that organization. And literally thousands of wild animals of all kinds in Britain around that area get a second chance out there after they've been injured or orphaned or poisoned or whatever happens to them. So it's a wonderful thing. And against that is the political side. And Anne was also a politically aware person. She'd been politically active at the time when the hunting law was passed, the Hunting Act, which actually technically forbids fox hunting in Britain. It still goes on. You know, a lot of illegal things go on, but at least it's still illegal. So I became a person who was involved in saving animals one by one, from field mice to voles to deer to birds of prey or whatever, and on the other hand, trying to deal with it at a national level, at policy level, and trying to make sure that laws are in place to protect all creatures.
Oh, that's fabulous.
It's a tough battle.
I'm sure it's a tough battle.
The end of that sentence is it's a tough battle, especially with the government, the kind of governments we've had in the last few years. You know, there is no empathy in these governments. And, I mean, in my opinion, we're governed by people of rather low human qualities. And I think it's very sad, you know, that we're governed by money issues and very little else.
I think we have a similar situation in Canada. I mean, we have the same electoral system from Britain. We inherited it, and we've been trying to switch to a proportional system, but...
These people love to hang on to their power, don't they? It seems like this ancient saying is so true, that power corrupts, and, you know, what is it? All power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. It seems to be true, sadly.
One of my last questions, I guess, is you own some land in Dorset, and you're trying to restore it to a natural woodland. In Britain, of course, we know that the landscape has been transformed over, I guess, hundreds of years at least, when we're talking about humans. Mm-hmm. There is very little, I guess, original woodland left in England.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Very, very little. In fact, some people would say none. Yeah, there's some quite close to original indigenous woodland, as you might call it. And it's a complex issue. If you're talking about rewilding and returning Britain to its native state, it's not possible really to completely do this. At least you can't force it. You know, we have projects going in England to kill all the grey squirrels so that you can put all the red squirrels back. And it's really a doomed and rather, in my opinion, misguided project, because you're trying to put part of wildlife back to the way it was without putting the whole world back to the way it was, and it's not really possible. So what I try to do is start off with the landscape and get rid of the pesticides, get rid of commercial considerations as much as I can, and try to encourage the landscape to return to the way it would have been without human intervention. It's amazing that it does it quite quickly. And I planted 101,000 trees in one particular area, which is a sort of ring area around the forest that I had. And already the wildlife there is absolutely stunning. And I think, a lot of people are surprised how quickly something that you might call a natural balance is restoring itself. Of course, it's a bit of a myth, a natural balance, because nothing's balanced, everything's in motion. As we know, you know, the coral reef isn't in balance, it's in perpetual battle, and so is the rest of the world. But it's, in my opinion, generally a healthier battle without human intervention.
You've been quoted as saying that you'd rather be remembered for the work you did for animals than, you know, your musical career or your scientific accomplishments. Why did you say that?
I think I do feel that. Yeah. I think art and music and science are all very worthy pursuits and have a value in their own right. But if you set that against basic human health and dignity and rights to a decent life and a decent death, then I think I would go for the latter as priority. I don't think you can become this artless, humorless being that only is concerned about life and death. You know, that's not a good place to be. That's a one-dimensional place to put yourself. So to me, it's all important. But I would love to go to my grave thinking that I'd made some kind of a difference to the way we perceive and treat the other animals in our beautiful planet.
And is legislation the answer? And do you think it could happen in England?
It's part of the answer, yes, and it is happening too slowly. But it needs a public consciousness to give the will to politicians. And it needs, in my opinion, a bit of a breakthrough and a realization that money isn't everything. That economics is actually a load of bollocks. You know, people thought I was joking when I did this video called Bollocks to the Economy a number of years ago now, you know, as a comment on the electoral process. But it was actually a very serious comment, because I don't think these people who got into power on the basis of supposedly being good at economics were actually any good at it at all. And it was all talk. And even if economics, in inverted commas, had benefited, the country as a whole actually wouldn't have done, because it's about quality of life, which is not just about money.
Well, thank you so much, Brian May, for joining us today, and it was a pleasure speaking to you.
Pleasure speaking to you, Ryan, and God bless you all of you out there who care.
And that was my interview with Dr. Brian May, the guitar player in Queen, who also has a PhD in astrophysics and is very active as an animal campaigner. He campaigns for the rights and the welfare of all animals, I guess around the world, but especially in the UK. And I spoke to Brian May in 2017 when he was here in Montreal for a Queen concert with Adam Lambert. So you are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. If you ever want to find out more about Brian May, he does have a website, which is brianmay.com. All right, well, for the rest of the show, I thought we would look at bats. And I've been noticing some bats in the sky during the evening lately around where I live on the West Island of Montreal. And I know that many bat species have declined a lot because of something called the white nose syndrome, which is this ailment that bats are getting. Specifically the bats that hibernate in caves this far north. You know, basically, if they hibernate in northeastern North America, they are susceptible to this disease or this ailment. So we're going to listen to a webinar that was recently done with a specialist on bats. His name is Craig Willis, and he's a professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Winnipeg. And he's talking here about why North American bats are in trouble, and he's talking about research that he and others have done trying to figure out this fungal disease called white nose syndrome that has led to a collapse of multiple North American bat species. So here is that webinar, which has been edited, shortened, and so on and so forth, and made more appropriate for radio. So here it is now.
So the pathogen that causes our bat disease, white nose syndrome, falls into a category that that I've referred to as conservation pathogens. These are usually microbes, disease-causing organisms that have really massive conservation-relevant impacts on their hosts. And so a few examples here. We're going to talk quite a lot about bats and white nose syndrome, this white stuff growing on this bat. Probably more famous, or at least longer known, is amphibian chytridiomycosis, which has led to extinctions of multiple frog species throughout the world over the last several decades. Often conservation pathogens are invasive species. They've come from somewhere else and they're impacting naive hosts that haven't evolved some mechanism of resistance or tolerance to that particular organism. And finally, conservation pathogens may impact hosts that are already threatened by some other form of impact, like habitat loss or habitat fragmentation. And that's something we'll come back to a bit later on, the importance of the environment, both in the sort of impacts of white nose syndrome, but I think especially in how we might respond to the disease from a management perspective. Like many people that work in conservation and work with endangered species, I tend to oscillate between hopefulness and despair. Lately, though, I'm sort of on the hopeful side, and I think that with enough resources, with enough investment, we can potentially manage for these kinds of complex multi-host pathogen outbreaks that are associated with conservation pathogens. Before I get to that stuff, though, I think it's worth talking a little bit about why we should care about bats specifically. We definitely should care about wildlife disease. Bats, I think we should care about for a few reasons. First, they're just cool. And just watching bats fly, this amazing maneuverability, this amazing ability to get around in complete darkness under their own power, it's hard for anyone who's remotely interested in nature not to be a bit interested in that. And so I think they're just cool in their own right. That ability to fly under their own power has led to an extraordinary diversification. Bats occur everywhere on Earth where there is forest for them to live in. They've diversified into well over 1,200 species. One in five mammal species is a bat. And this little brown bat is the one we're going to talk most about today. These species hibernate underground for the winter. In Manitoba, we're lucky to have a series of caves in the Interlake region between Lake Manitoba and Lake Winnipeg. Lots of fantastic hibernation habitat for these species. So neat aspects of their biology, incredible diversity around the world, but also ecologically and economically important. In Canada, all of our bats eat insects. We don't have good data for Canada at this point, but there are some experiments from the tropics. And one really neat experiment from the Midwestern US that shows if you exclude bats from foraging over corn crops, if you put a big exclosure over the crops at night and prevent bats from feeding on insects above that crop, you get significantly more pest damage in those crops. And scaling those results up, estimates suggest bats are worth billions for agriculture in the US. So they're ecologically and economically important, as well as just being cool and interesting. And so for that reason, when biologists in New York State went into their hibernation sites to count bats in the wintertime to do their annual surveys for bats, instead of finding scenes like this with clusters and cuddles of bats all hanging out together on the ceiling and walls of the cave, huddling together throughout the winter, they found devastating scenes like this. Carpets of dead bats littering the floors of those hibernation sites, little skeletons mixed in with the substrate, and a few individuals surviving with this white stuff all over their noses, their ears, and all over their wings. And so that white stuff on the noses led to a name pretty quickly, white nose syndrome. That white stuff was quickly identified as a fungus that we now refer to as Pseudogymnoascus destructans, or PD for short. People quickly worked out that it's cold tolerant. We can't get it. Humans can't get it, for example, because it doesn't grow above about 20 degrees. So it's adapted to grow at cold temperatures above freezing, and hibernating bat skin during the winter time is the perfect temperature for growth of this particular fungus. Folks also quickly worked out that the fungus was only invading the skin. So the bats didn't have systemic infections. It wasn't infecting organs and deep tissues. This was a cutaneous infection. And so people quickly gathered when we saw hundreds of thousands of dead bats. A small group of folks gathered in Albany, New York, near the first discovery of this disease in June of 2008. And this was a group of a few people that studied bats, but also experienced people in wildlife veterinary disease, wildlife pathologists, experts in wildlife pathogens. And one of the consistent messages we heard at this meeting was that it must be something other than the fungus, because fungal pathogens don't kill mammals. Fungal pathogens kill plants, and sometimes they kill amphibians. And as we've seen from chytridiomycosis, they can kill amphibians in massive numbers. But we don't tend to see a lot of really deadly fungal diseases of mammals unless the mammals are already immunocompromised. And so people hypothesize that something else was the driving cause, and that this fungus was a secondary infection, a secondary result of some other environmental change, potentially. A few of us thought maybe the white stuff growing all over the bats could help explain why bats were dying. And so we set out to do some experiments to test that hypothesis. Can the fungus alone cause the disease in bats? And so we collected some little brown bats from the wild, brought them back to the lab, to our very high humidity and low temperature incubators, conditions that closely match good hibernation conditions for bats in nature. We attached little temperature-sensitive data loggers, backpacks, to each bat so we could record their hibernation body temperatures. And then we inoculated them with the fungus and sham inoculated a control group. So we wanted to test whether we could replicate disease in healthy bats and otherwise healthy bats. And what did we find? Well, sure enough, our inoculated bats had the characteristic signs of the disease. Now, what did we see in terms of hibernation body temperatures? Well, recall we put these temperature backpacks on the bats to understand what they're doing in hibernation. What hibernating mammals do during hibernation is spend most of their time at low body temperatures. So here I've plotted skin temperature or body temperature over about a 3-month period. And what you'll see is that a healthy bat is spending about 3 weeks or so, a couple of weeks, at this really low body temperature, about 7 degrees. And every few weeks or so, it rewarms to a normal body temperature. It spends a ton of stored fat to do this. And in fact, most of the fat that bats store in the fall to prepare for hibernation is spent on these periodic arousals to a normal body temperature. Okay. Well, what happened with our infected bats? They started out hibernating normally, but by about day 50 to day 70, they start warming up much too often. And that's a worry for otherwise healthy bats because each of these arousals costs about 3 weeks worth of fat, dramatically shortens how long the bats might be able to survive if they're warming up too much and burning through their fat reserves too quickly. Now, at around the time of our 2008 white-nose syndrome meeting, we were finding in the northeastern U.S. in a number of places really massive die-offs of bats and this white stuff growing on bats. Folks in the old world started to wonder whether this fungus was something they needed to worry about. And so they started looking for white stuff growing on bats. But importantly, there was no die-off of bats being observed in the old world. And that raises a couple of possibilities, a couple of hypotheses. One of these is that our North American fungus, the one killing our bats, is an invasive species from Europe. The other is that this fungus had already occurred on bats in both North America and Europe, but something funny had happened in North America to suddenly make it deadly. Perhaps there'd been a mutation in the fungus, perhaps there'd been an environmental change that affected its virulence or how severe disease it might cause. And so we tested that by taking fungus isolated from bats in Europe that wasn't killing European bats and tested whether we could cause disease in our North American bats. And sure enough, when we did that, we saw the exact same effects as our North American fungus. The European fungus caused disease that was equally severe for North American bats, which means their fungus in the old world is deadly for our bats, and it's consistent with this invasive species hypothesis. Also consistent with this hypothesis is the fact that one of the first sites where white nose syndrome was discovered is a major tourist attraction in New York State in the northeastern U.S. Gets thousands and thousands of visitors every year. You can take lantern tours, you can take boat tours, you can get married in the cave if that's something that happens to interest you. Lots of people visit this place. We'll probably never know for sure exactly how it got here, but that provides some circumstantial evidence that perhaps a tourist tracked the fungus across on their boots and it was exposed to our bats that way. So where are we now? We now know that about 17 species have been found carrying the fungus. 11 of those are more or less affected. We've seen some evidence of at least small population declines. And we know, so that is one of the features that can make for a nasty conservation pathogen. If you've got multiple host species that vary in their susceptibility. Another factor I mentioned early on that leads to or can contribute to a conservation pathogen is the ability to survive in the environment without the host. And our fungus does that very nicely. It can live in caves when bats aren't there. So bats can get reinfected when they return to an infected cave in the fall. It's had massive impacts on at least a few species. We've lost count of how many animals have been killed in total, but it's definitely in the millions, almost certainly, if not the fastest, among the fastest declines of wild mammals ever observed. And as a result, we've now listed three species as federally endangered in Canada. And so these are some plots from a recent paper by Fred Frick at Bat Conservation International, showing declines in size of a couple of colonies. You can see there is a massive crash within about 2 years of detection of the fungus. And then these particular colonies have stayed at really low levels. They haven't quite winked out yet. What we also see in those colonies is that fungal load, the other set of data on these plots, has increased in those caves and then stabilized at a high level. So there's fungus there, and that fungus isn't going away, despite how rare our hosts happen to be. Now, my students and I have been most focused on trying to understand why a simple fungal skin infection would cause bats to warm up too much and potentially burn through their energy too quickly. And so one of the first places we looked was at healthy hibernators. Why do healthy hibernators do those periodic arousals or do those periodic warm-ups during the winter? What causes them to do that? We don't have a clear answer for that. It's probably a multi-pronged cause. There are probably multiple sort of physiological issues that cause that to happen. But one thing that probably contributes is dehydration. During those long bouts at low body temperature, the bats are losing a little bit of water. And in fact, they lose water constantly, even across folded up wings as they're sitting there hibernating. And so one of the things they do when they warm up is take a drink. And we wondered if the fungus growing into this highly vascularized wing tissue could create injuries leading to increased fluid loss, thereby causing bats to rewarm too quickly. And so we looked at blood samples from our inoculation experiment to try and understand what was going on with infected versus uninfected bats. And we saw a couple of things. One of the things we saw was that our infected bats had much, much lower levels of plasma electrolytes. That is the same stuff you drink in Gatorade after a big workout, has dropped to much lower levels. And so our bats are low in important plasma electrolytes. And they also had signs of dramatic fluid loss. And so we're seeing evidence of low plasma electrolytes and really severe dehydration. So a skin infection is really causing a catastrophic disruption of hibernation energy balance. Bats with this disease, they've stored up a whole bunch of fat in the fall, but that fat isn't enough to see them through to the spring with these extra physiological consequences of the fungus. And so that leads us into the second part of what I'd like to talk about today, how we might use some of what we've learned about the disease to maybe try and help some bat populations, to try and do some management. And I think one of the first things we've done, this is it's a little bit low-hanging fruit, although it hasn't necessarily been easy, but once we were able to show that, yes, indeed, the fungus was what was killing the bats, that gave some justification for really doing a job of convincing people to properly decontaminate their boots when they visit caves, to get researchers and cavers to be very conscious of biosafety so that we reduce the rate of spread of the disease, at least reduce the chance that people can spread it from place to place. And so those of us doing research on bats, the tens of thousands of people that are cavers in the United States that visit caves regularly for recreation and research, those people are now doing a whole lot more of this decontamination, which has been really important. So we've been wondering whether we can support the evolution of improved energy balance in bats suffering from white nose syndrome. And one of the ways we might do that is, again, relying on habitat. And in this case, perhaps improving summer habitat. We know that bats love warm roosts to raise their pups. Presumably, if they're in worse condition in spring, having just survived the fungus, they'll need to have even better roosts to recover from the disease and to raise pups. And so what we've been testing is actually whether we can enhance roost structures for bats. This is one of the ways we're testing this, using a heated bat box that we raise to a slightly higher temperature than normal to try and improve spring and summer roosts and improve recovery from the disease and reproduction by those survivors. We've got some evidence that little brown bats really love these hot boxes in the summertime. This is a flight enclosure experiment where we've got one heated box and three regular temperature boxes in this flight tent. We let a bunch of bats go into the flight tent. So one hot box, three regular ambient temperature boxes. And what we find is that the proportion of bats in that one hot box is much, much higher almost all the time. Sometimes they're kind of evenly distributed, but on several nights in this experiment, all the bats went into just one of the boxes. So just a really strong preference. And so we've been working with landowners all over central Canada, from western Manitoba into central Ontario, to test out these prototype heated bat boxes at known bat colonies. We've set these up, either heated boxes or control boxes, at existing colonies that the public has told us about. We're testing these out. We're not recommending that people put them up themselves yet, because it is possible they could make things worse if they encourage bats to aggregate much more than they otherwise might. It's possible that this kind of enhancement could actually increase the spread of our fungus. And that's something that we're actively testing, and we definitely want to rule out before we recommend folks taking this approach. Okay, I'm just about finished, and I just want to quickly go through some lessons I think we've learned from white nose syndrome that hopefully will be of interest to some of the folk. One of the things I think that we've learned from this disease is, and this may be preaching to the choir for many of you, but baseline pre-disease data were incredibly important for our initial response. This sounds strange to say, but we were lucky in our disease in having one of our species first affected was already federally endangered. The Indiana bat, or Myotis sodalis, was in the sort of epicenter of white nose syndrome right from the beginning. And that meant for the sites where this bat occurred, we had amazing long-term data, long-term census data, count data to help us understand the impacts on this species, but also the other species that shared hibernation sites with Indiana bats. And in the US, we also had federal coordination right away. The US Fish and Wildlife Service, because we're dealing with a federally endangered bat, could provide some real leadership immediately. And I think white nose syndrome kind of broke out in just about the perfect place to have a reasonably fast response. Citizen science has also helped, and it's most of the original observations of white nose syndrome in Ontario and many in Quebec came from concerned citizens reporting unusual behavior by bats. We've since partnered with the Quebec government and the Quebec Center for Biodiversity Science, who set up this amazing website, the Neighborhood Bat Watch. We've expanded it to Ontario and Manitoba, and it's spreading to other parts of the country where folks can report bat colonies, report their observations of bats, and we're getting great information from the Bat Watch site. Finally, just want to end with my take-home messages. Again, I think white nose syndrome is a great example of an important conservation pathogen. There are many others, and this is really a problem for wildlife conservation, but also for people. Finally, I think even though we have no solutions yet, we've made tremendous progress by learning from diseases that have come before white nose syndrome. And I think the response to white nose syndrome is helping newly emerged disease response teams deal with their issues even more quickly as well.
And that was a webinar by Dr. Craig K.R. Willis, who is a professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Winnipeg. He specializes in the study of bats, and he was talking about various research about white nose syndrome, which has led to the collapse of many North American bat species. You have been listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks so much for joining us. You can always email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca. You can also check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUT Montreal. We do have a little website, which is called equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And that's also where the interview we played at the beginning of the show with Brian May from Queen, you can find the link to that interview on the website that we have that I just mentioned, but it's on our SoundCloud page, so you would link to it from there. So thanks for listening to today's show, and we're going to leave you with some music from Childish Gambino, and that is the tune Redbone. Childish Gambino, of course, is a guy that's also, his real name is Donald Glover, Donald Glover Jr. You know, he is an American actor, comedian, singer, rapper, producer, writer, and director. And I find this song is a lot like the old funkadelic tunes from the 70s. So I love it. So this is Redbone. Enjoy.
minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your body vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do with my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in.